And now, brethren and sisters and young people, I should like to invite your very close attention to the words our brother Brian Luke has prepared for us tonight, to the title, The Waters of Shiloh That Go Softly. Thanks.
Dear brother Klaus and my dear brethren and sisters and our young people in Christ Jesus. Now, in our Isaiah class last time, we covered one of the most wonderful parts of the record of Isaiah, as it's found there in verse 14 as a summary, where in the diffidence of Ahaz, the wicked diffidence of Ahaz, God even promised him a sign if he would ask whether it was in the height or in the depth. And when he would not, and had the audacity to say, "Is it a small thing for you to weary men? But will ye weary to God? But will ye weary my God also?" as said the prophet Isaiah. That's another one of those statements of the prophet himself as he feels the real import of the situation before him. "Is it a small thing for you to weary men? But will ye weary my God also?" said the prophet. It's a personal statement, isn't it? And therefore, verse 14, arising quite miraculously out of all of those circumstances, "Therefore the Lord himself shall give you a sign. He offered before and you would not take it. You could have asked whatever you like. Therefore the Lord himself shall give you a sign." In an illustration of his wondrous grace, it was something of the ultimate blessing. "Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel." The house of David, verse 13. The house of David, verse 2. To whom came the promise of a son to come, a seed of David, and a son of God. "I will be his father, he shall be my son." In this, the trough of Judah's existence, in the very trough of all of the circumstances that were upon them, the invasions that came from every side of that kingdom, and the spiritual despondency which fell upon that nation because of the ill nature of the king, in the midst of all that came that promise. God had not forgotten. Had he promised to David, he would surely fulfill. "A virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and he'll be unique. For when he comes, there will be as though God was there. God with us will be his name." And then, speaking of his spiritual nourishment, in verse 15 it said, "Butter and honey shall he eat, the very best of God's promises and word and commandments, that he may know to refuse the evil and choose the good. For before the child shall know to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land that thou abhorrest shall be forsaken of both her kings." Now, insomuch that it said that, it required that there should be a primary application. The words of verse 14 we know refer to our Lord Jesus Christ, the Son of God. For they're quoted specifically, aren't they? Matthew 1, verse 23. But when it says in verse 16, "But before the child shall know to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land that thou abhorrest shall be forsaken of both her kings," that has reference to those two kings mentioned in verse 8. The head of Syria is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is Rezin. The two kings were the kings of Syria and the northern kingdom of Israel. And it's saying that before this child shall know to refuse the evil and choose the good, then those two kings would both be departed from the scene. And as we said last night, the obvious understanding of that passage must surely be that King Hezekiah was going to fulfill that. That amazing king, that king of remarkable and sterling faith, who was able to, out of this spiritual wilderness, raise again the height of Judah's aspirations to her God. And a wonderful deliverance was given when the city was invested by the Assyrians. And through the strength of that king, the strength of his faith, and the work of the prophet with him, the answer came of God. And eventually they looked out, didn't they, over the wall, and 185,000 Assyrians lay dead in their tents that morning. Such was the deliverance that was given because of the faith of great King Hezekiah. However, Assyria's scourge was going to truly be felt by Judah. Jerusalem might indeed be spared, but the kingdom of Judah was going to feel the effects of the king of Assyria. So in verse 17, the scene is balanced. Ahaz's wickedness will not become unrewarded. Yahweh shall bring upon thee, and upon thy people, and upon thy father's house. You notice that the message is still to the king. I'd like you to gain the understanding, my dear brothers and sisters, that chapter 7 are messages spoken to the king, whereas chapter 8 will be messages spoken to the people. But this is still essentially to the king. Yahweh shall bring upon thee, and upon thy people, and upon thy father's house, the house of David, that's reiterated in verse 13 and in verse 2. Terrible days. Days that have not come from the day that Ephraim departed from Judah, even the king of Assyria. When, of course, the northern kingdom departed from the allegiance which it had to Jerusalem in the days of King Rehoboam and Jeroboam, it was an historic occasion in the life of that kingdom, wasn't it? Those that had been brothers before became 10 and 2, and the division was permanent. And so Isaiah is saying that, like as that was historic, you have to sort of go back through the path of those two kingdoms, and there was an historic break at that point. Well, then what is going to now happen upon Judah? We'll see something of a similar kind. You'll have to put it in the context of an event like that to see the monumental nature of the impending tragedy that King Assyria will bring. So verse 18, and it shall come to pass in that day that Yahweh shall hiss, for the fly that is in the uttermost parts of the river of Egypt, and for the bee that is in the land of Assyria. Now the fly and the bee are being called by God, called to come upon the kingdom of Judah in tremendous numbers. So we read in verse 19, and they shall come, and shall rest all of them in the desolate valleys, and in the holes of the rocks, and upon all thorns, and upon all bushes. And then it says, changing the figure from the fly and the bee, it says, in the same day shall the Lord shave with a razor that is hired, namely by them beyond the river. So the one that will exercise the razor is the king of Assyria. And that which is going to be shorn is the whole of that person, the head and the hair even of the feet. And there's not too much hair on the feet, is there? But as if to speak of the completeness of the shoring of that kingdom of Judah, it speaks even of the hair of the feet, and it shall also consume the beard. Now, if you come to Jeremiah chapter 7, you will see that Jeremiah, I'm sure, plays upon that earlier figure of speech, not in respect to the Assyrian this time, but in respect to the invasion that was prominent at his time, that is, to the Babylonian invasion. In Jeremiah chapter 7 and verse 29, we read this: cut off thine hair. And that's the word nezer, which means separation. It's the word for the Nazarite, isn't it? From which we get the word Nazarite. Nezer, N-E-Z-E-R. Cut off thine hair, it says. Cut off thy separation. In other words, the hair of thy separation. It was the flowing hair of the Nazarite that indicated, didn't it, his separation. Cut off the hair of thy separation, O Jerusalem, and cast it away. In other words, it was a show without reality. And take up a lamentation on high places, for Yahweh hath rejected and forsaken the generation of his wrath. For the children of Judah have done evil in my sight, saith Yahweh. They have set their abominations in the house which is called by my name to pollute it. Cut off the hair of thy separation, O Jerusalem. Well, that's a very similar figure of speech to what we have back in Isaiah chapter 7. But did you notice in chapter 7 verse 20 that it said that the one that would exercise the razor is someone who has been hired? That is, he has been paid a price to do that. He's been rented for a certain specific purpose. Now, there's a most interesting background to that. We have briefly referred to it, you may remember, but turn back with me to the 2nd of Chronicles, if you would. 2nd of Chronicles, chapter 28. In the 2nd of Chronicles, chapter 28, the chapter which really portrays this incorrigible king, though God should smite him one way and smite him another, he would still turn away from him. Though he would offer him sign, yet he would spurn that opportunity. So in the 2nd of Chronicles, chapter 28, verse 19, we read, "For Yahweh brought Judah low because of Ahaz, king of Israel, for he made Judah naked and transgressed sore against Yahweh. And Tilgath-Pilneser, king of Assyria, came unto him and distressed him, but strengthened him not." You see in verse 16, remember, at that time did King Ahaz send unto the kings of Assyria to help him. Well, they came eventually, but they distressed him and helped him not. He looked for strength from them. But he came to Judah's grief. But verse 21 says, of the money that was paid to hire this razor. For Ahaz took away a portion out of the house of the Lord and out of the house of the king and of the princes and gave it unto the king of Assyria. But he helped him not. And verse 23, he sacrificed unto the gods of Damascus, which smote him. And he said, because the gods of the kings of Syria helped them, therefore will I sacrifice to them that they may help me. But they were the ruin of him and of all Israel. So in that way, the solicitations of Ahaz towards Tilgath-Pileser, and then the giving of him of certain rewards if he would only come and do this job, was the hiring of this razor power that when it came would leave not a skerrick, not a hair as it were, upon the body politic of the kingdom of Judah. And so verse 21 to 25, in a most interesting way, portray to us the desolation that would come upon that land. Indeed, it would be the shaving of a very keen razor. Look at the novel scene of verse 21. To a kingdom that had been, through many previous years, enjoying great prosperity. It shall come to pass in that day that a man shall nourish a young cow and two sheep. That's not a lot, is it? But that's his possessions. That's his property. A cow and two sheep. What's happened to his herds and his flocks? What's happened to his property? It shall come to pass, verse 22, for the abundance of milk that they shall give, he shall eat butter. In other words, although there's so few, the abundance of feed is so great because there's so little flocks, so little herds to feed upon that which is there, that if there is a sheep and two young sheep, then they will flow with goodness. Because there's just such an abundance of pasture for them. And then verse 22 curiously says, for butter and honey shall everyone eat that is left in the land. In other words, they will have plenty. There will be so few left that they will be well provided for. The razor will so seriously deplete the population of that kingdom that which is left will be living in butter and honey. You remember when they came into the land at the beginning? The promise of Moses to them was that they would go into a land flowing with milk and honey. That land has now become greatly depopulated. And the promise is still true, however, to the remnant, the Sheer Jashub, the remnant that shall return, but there'll be very few. And that remnant will enjoy such a wide space of land that they will enjoy it in prosperity. Lands and no people to fill it. For butter and honey shall everyone eat that is left in the land. When you turn back, however, and your mind obviously makes a connection, doesn't it, with verse 15. Verse 15 we didn't understand, did we? In terms of that which might be found in the dairy cooperative. Butter and honey we understood to mean far more than that. It was speaking of the nourishment of this Son of God, wasn't it? That he would receive butter and honey. We're not particularly interested in the diet that he had in Nazareth, are we? It's speaking of the spiritual blessings with which this child shall be nurtured. That his instruction that would come from God would be rich and fat and full of the goodness of God. Isaiah chapter 50 spoke of that instruction, didn't it? Here's the butter and the honey. The Lord God, Isaiah 50 and verse 4. The Lord God hath given me the tongue of the learned, that I should know how to speak a word in season to him that is weary. He wakeneth morning by morning. He wakeneth mine ear to hear as the learned. There's the butter and the honey, isn't it? The spiritual riches of God will be laid upon the table of that young and devouring Son of God, and he would grow greatly by it. He would grow in favour with God and with men. And so, that being the understanding, when we turn over just to verse 22, and we read, therefore, butter and honey shall everyone eat that is left in the land, that's got to have more to it, doesn't it, than the fact that there will be a material abundance. It's surely got to mean that this remnant that are left have come to evaluate more seriously the blessings that God has given that people. They will no longer be like Ahaz, who when he was offered spiritual blessings, spurned it. The particular one, verse 15, he was going to take of the butter and honey so that he would know to refuse the evil and choose the good. Ahaz couldn't care less about choosing the good and refusing the evil. But the remnant that are left after the invasion, they will be of a different kind. Butter and honey shall everyone eat that is left in the land. And you can see the sense of that, isn't it? That is left is the same sense as the remnant. The remnant, in other words, will have a spiritual disposition to greatly esteem the blessings that God has given them in the spiritual riches which he had poured upon that nation. They will not be Ahaz-like. They will be like the true Emmanuel. And by that reason, God would dwell with them. And so we read in verse 23, and what a curious verse this has always seemed to me. It shall come to pass in that day that every place shall be where there were 1,000 vines at 1,000 silverlings, it shall even be for briars and thorns. Now I used to read the silverlings as in some way related to trees. And I could never really understand what that verse meant until I read in another translation, and others support it, what, for example, the Revised Standard Version says. It says, instead of at 1,000 silverlings, it says, for 1,000 pieces of silver. shall come to pass in that day that every place shall be where there were 1,000 vines for 1,000 pieces of silver. In other words, very highly priced property, very good ground, very well chosen land. It shall even be for briars and thorns. Now, can you see the sense of that? Where a man had tended his vineyard for many centuries of time on that piece of land that God had given him, that had been such a wonderful family heritage, and he cared for that year after year, generation after generation. That esteemed property would go back to briars and thorns. That's what the verse is talking about. Interesting memory I have of a time going through Natal, the province of Natal in South Africa. You know, it was part of the international pressure upon the South Africans that they should give land back, inverted commas for back, that they should give land to the majority black population. And so in Natal there are quite a number of areas which are subscribed off for the black man. And when one passes these areas, you can see, for example, on the rise of the land, you see a very large home. But instead of being kept up, it's all dilapidated. You have been passing through areas where there were lovely homes and many other smaller homes and beautiful cane growing and everything absolutely kept up beautifully with a South African fastidiousness. Everything done beautifully in those properties. And then you pass these lands and you find that it's all gone back almost to bush. Although tremendous amounts of money were put into that land, the present tenders of the fields just simply are incapable of bringing that land to the degree of fertility and husbandry that it enjoyed in the past. Now that's just an interesting reflection upon verse 23 that comes to my mind as way of illustration. The briars and thorns eventually spring up. The little trees that were there before begin to grow again until eventually the whole thing goes back to the kind of native land that it was in the past. Did you hear an echo? Briars and thorns. Remember Isaiah's earlier chapter, Isaiah chapter 5? Here's a very close tie-up. Isaiah's like this all the way through, my dear brothers and sisters. It really is full of little ties. You know, those that speak about two Isaiahs, the Deutero-Isaiah, they really must be crazy to go past all the obvious tie-ups in language that flow right through from chapter 1 to chapter 66. You remember this is the parable of the vineyard, verse 1, and how it said in verse 4, "What could have been done more to my vineyard that I have not done in it? Wherefore, when I looked that it should bring forth grapes, brought it forth wild grapes. And now go to, I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will take away the hedge thereof, and it shall be eaten up, and break down the wall thereof, and it shall be trodden down." In other words, the foreigner would come into that which had been tended so long, and I will lay it waste. It shall not be pruned nor digged, but there shall come up briars and thorns. And I'll command the clouds that they rain no rain upon it. Now that's a very similar passage to what we have in the 7th chapter and verse 23. Very prized properties. 1,000 vines, 1,000 pieces of silver. But now it has returned, as the earlier chapter said. The vineyard has been invaded. And so verse 24 says, "With arrows and with bows shall men come thither, because all the land shall become briars and thorns." Now I just suggest there's perhaps two possible renditions of verse 24. It's not easy to be sure of exactly the sense of that passage. Does it mean that the arrows and the bows are those of the invaders? If so, then why does it say, "because all the land shall become briars and thorns"? the sense of the verse seems to me to be that the land has become briars and thorns, and because of that, men with arrows and bows come thither to hunt. Isn't that the sense of it? Because we're speaking of an invasion of the Assyrian, one is inclined to say the arrows and the bows are that of the Assyrian. Yet the verse itself seems to lend itself more to the second thought. In other words, then, if the second thought is the correct one, where we have before such ordered husbandry on lovely, well-nurtured pastures or land beforehand, now that has become the place where men would even take bow and arrow to hunt. So much has it gone back into the wilderness in which it was originally found. And in keeping with that thought, verse 25 says, "And on all hills that shall be digged with the mattock, there shall not come thither the fear of briars and thorns. But it shall be for the sending forth of oxen and for the treading of lesser cattle," or as it literally should be, the treading of sheep. "On all hills that shall be digged with the mattock." Now the mattock was an instrument used for removal of the weeds, for the briars and thorns. "On all hills then that used to be tilled with the mattock," chapter 5 verse 6 again, where it said in verse 6, "I will lay it waste, it shall not be pruned nor digged." And there's your other echo back to chapter 5 verse 6. So it's the same theme then as verse 23. Land that used to be for vegetables and for close planting of all kinds of good things. Very good land that was used for the most productive things. "There shall not come thither the fear of briars and thorns." Why verse 25? "It shall be for the sending forth of oxen and for the treading of sheep." In other words, it becomes pastoral country. All the difference, my dear brothers and sisters, you might say, between that in country, like you might find in the hills, or in the close vicinity of the northern plains, where all of the vegetables and other matters are grown for, say, the city of Adelaide. And then way up in the north, you will have your pastoral country. And so in Israel, it's a very similar country. Verse 25 is saying that the in country, the very good country, the strong country, where men would carefully tend even a weed and take it out, yet that will become as if it was like the pastoral country in which there's just an occasional piece of grass and men just run their cattle and sheep upon it. In other words, there's not enough people for the size of the land. Now, that's the end of chapter 7. And as we said, that represents a series of injunctions against the king. Imagine the king listening to that load of thoughts. It's very difficult to say if they were all given on one occasion. What is clear is that they were essentially given to the king. Now, I want you, by way of contrast, to notice that chapter 8 is different. See chapter 8, verse 6. "For as much as this people," verse 7, "now therefore behold the Lord bringeth upon them," verse 11, or verse 9, "associate yourselves, O ye people," verse 11, towards the end of that verse, "that I should not walk in the way of this people," verse 12, "say ye not a confederacy to all them to whom this people shall say a confederacy." So here now, departing from the royal company, the prophet turns to the people as a whole. It's one thing for the king to go off on his willful apostasy, but in the end, every person is going to bear the consequence of that. They too have the opportunity of standing up against that which the king is leading them into. But you see, they are not going to do it. Because whilst the king's heart was apostate, the people's heart was very little better. And so there would come a time, see verse 15 and 16, when many among them shall stumble and fall and be broken and be snared and be taken and only a remnant will be left. Bind up the testimony, seal the law among my disciples. In other words, the kingdom of Judah as a whole would go the way of their sovereign. And left among them would be but a remnant, the Shear Jasher, among whom the word of God would be sealed and bound up in their hearts. So that's the difference in the nature of chapter 7 and 8. Now let's have a look at chapter 8, verses 1 to 4. The message of Maher Shalal Hashbaz. By the way, it's quite possible that some of these different messages of chapter 8 were given contemporaneous to those of chapter 7. That is to say, at the same time. We read in verse 1 that Yahweh said unto me, take thee a great roll, and write in it with a man's pen concerning Maher Shalal Hashbaz. Now when you read different commentaries about a great roll, you get all kinds of different ideas, but really there's no question about what that really means. It means, without a question, it means a tablet on which things can be written. The Hebrew word is the word gileon. I'll just give you that because it's rarely used. A gileon. A great roll. As a matter of fact, it only has one other reference, and that's in Isaiah's third chapter, where it's translated quite reasonably as mirror. Part of the equipment of the woman in Israel who was doing herself up in those times. And Young's literal says that it means a polished writing tablet. I want to make that sort of clear, because when you look up different translations, you get all sorts of ideas and different commentaries even more so. But it doesn't mean a roll. It doesn't mean something you roll up. It's never used in that sense. And the word from which it has come does not have that sense. Then it says that it's a great roll. Take thee a great roll. In other words, it's not just a little tablet like we might put on the outside of our hall to announce our Sunday meetings. It is a great roll. It's a big placard. We're not told where the prophet was to put it. Perhaps he put it outside his home, or perhaps he put it outside the temple. But it was something that was going to draw a great deal of attention in a day, of course, that never had anything like the advertisements that we're so used to seeing in our world. So it was going to really attract attention. Now, Southerners, have a good look at this, because some terrific lessons that came out of this. It's going to be a great roll. It's going to attract attention. You know, something like Robert Roberts put out when he made a placard that went for 50 yards, or was it 100 yards? He and a little band of workers in Birmingham, when they had that first town hall lecture, they printed a banner that went right down the whole of a street. I don't know how many yards it was, but what an effort that was. Every eye looked at it, though, didn't they? There wouldn't have been a soul that went down that street that never read what was written on that placard. You see, that's what this is. It's drawing attention deliberately. It's not going to be unnoticed. Take thee a great roll. And then it says, and write in it with a man's pen. Now again, the word pen really does not mean pen. It's the word sheret. And it means a graving tool. If I told you that it was used in Exodus 32 verse 3... what was it used to engrave in? Exodus 32. When Moses went up. Close, but I wished it was. It wasn't the Ten Commandments, but Exodus 32 was something. Sorry, verse 4. Ten Commandments were written with the finger of of God. But if a man was writing them, they would have used something like this. In Exodus 32 and verse 4, "And he received them at their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool after he had made it a molten calf." Now that's the word. As far as I can see, that's the only other occurrence of the word. So it makes it very clear, doesn't it, that it was a tool that was used upon what we might expect. If it's a flat, strong, level surface, then it's going to need a tool that can indent that surface. It's not then a pen. It's a graving tool. So the picture that is given is that it's going to be a very major placard, and he's going to write into that placard. It's not going to be something that the rain will wash off on the first shower, but it's going to be indelibly imprinted into that placard. But it's interesting that it also says, write in it with a man's pen. A man's pen. Why man's pen? It's not in contrast to a lady's pen, like we might see today. What's the concept of a man's pen? Well, perhaps that's difficult until we know that the word man is the word Enosh, which has to do with the common man, the mortal man. It's a very common word, by the way, Enosh. Don't imagine it's just used here and there. If you look ahead, have a look in your concordance, you'll find that that word is used almost the same number as the word Adam. And so is the word Ish. They're very common words. We tend to really put them a long way apart. Well, I don't know whether that's altogether true. But certainly this word Enosh does have its origins, doesn't it? In Genesis chapter 4, and it does have the sense of mortality, man in his weakness. So what then does it mean? Write it in with a man's pen. Isn't that saying, write it in the common language. Write it in a way that is not necessarily scholastic, but which the common man, who is sick and in need of help, can read. In other words, God wanted to make sure that they could really understand. There's a couple of analogous passages to this. One is in Mark chapter 12, where we have a little expression concerning Jesus. It was the day after they'd asked him all those very difficult questions. Do you remember? And then he gave them one back. And in verse 37 of Mark 12 it says, "David therefore himself calleth him Lord. And whence is he then his son? And the common people heard him gladly." That's a very analogous thought, I believe. The common people heard him gladly. Write it in a man's pen and make it big, so that nobody can miss it. Here's another passage in Habakkuk. The prophecy of Habakkuk, chapter 2, verse 2. Habakkuk 2 and verse 2. This is God's retort to the prophet Habakkuk, who was a little bit uppish at this time. And so God answered him quite sternly in verse 2 and said, "And the Lord answered me and said, write the vision and make it plain upon tables, that he may run that readeth it." Get the point? Write it plain as any eye can see, that anyone can see what it means. Right, then he's responsible himself. So that he that readeth may run by the import of that message. So the apostle Habakkuk has a very similar import there. I think that's the sense of where Isaiah is told to write a great roll and to write it with a man's pen. You know, that's a terrific little exhortation to gospel advancement work, isn't it? That's what we're down here for. We're involved in preaching the gospel. What we need is a large placard, so to speak. Our advertisement has to be such that everybody in this area becomes clearly aware of what God is saying to the world in this time. That's a mighty responsibility. You know what would be a very good thing? For us to put a map out here of all these southern districts and to see the tremendous growth in these areas. Just as we were coming down Flaxmill Road and we turned down, the houses just keep on going and going. Far more than I really realised, even though I live in Adelaide. So we're living in a very rapidly growing area. We've got to make sure that we've got a placard sufficient there, that our gospel advancement is sufficiently keen and sufficiently concentrated and sufficiently enthusiastic that every ear down here is going to hear or see what that message is. So they won't be able, when Christ comes, to say, well, the brethren of Christ never told me. They will be able to read it, understand it, and do something about it. And if they don't, then it's upon their own heads. But we, for our part, my dear brothers and sisters, with a clear message written in a man's pen, so that the average common person can understand that, have the responsibility to put in their possession that knowledge that may lead to eternal life. You know, that's one of the great matters, isn't it, that faces us in this work. We have to have a love of slogging it out in the work of the truth. There is no question in my dear brothers and sisters, that there's going to be a very real work done in this area. The thing that we've got to do is take courage. Not to go into it with a blasé attitude as though this is going to be a nice little party. It's not going to be any party at all. But it'll be the greatest experience that all those that are involved will ever have in their lives. But it's going to be hard work. Continuous thought about where that ecclesia is going. Continuous thought about those who are listening to the truth. To bring their lives into Christ and be able to support them and their children and to bring them through all the difficulties which inevitably will come in the latter days and to see their feet implanted in sound paths in Christ. That is a major work, isn't it? And it requires great concentration of mind so that you're ringing up each other. You're in touch with each other. You're working as a team in the development of that. And not only yourselves who may be in this area, but all of us too must have our minds upon this work. You know, for a season, I believe our ecclesia has to really stop and concentrate upon that. We can't be doing everything, can we? But if we've set our hands to build a meeting down in this area, then we've got to give some concentration to that. And we can't be saying we haven't got time, or we haven't got money, or we haven't got something else. It will founder if we say that. Nor can we say, well, they want to go down there, okay, off you go. There's no fatherly attitude involved in that, is there? It's not the reaction of one meeting that is settled and comfortable upon another that is just beginning. It's a light stand just beginning. And we ought to be prepared, therefore, to give to that those of us who may not be upon the membership down here. We've got to be prepared to show an interest in it. Not just to come down as I have, when you might happen to be involved in a speaking appointment. We've got to be involved and interested. We've got to know what's happening down here and be interested in what's happening so that we are concentrating upon the advancement of that work in the southern area. And I believe that if we do that and we make our prayer unto our God, this area will truly blossom. It's got to. Look at the expansion of the suburbs in this area. We ought to take heart and courage and take the message of Isaiah here, where he was told to give what was indeed an unpopular message, but he did what he was asked to do, and his whole family became a series of prophets. Himself, his wife, as we will see, and his two children were all there to give signs to the nation of Judah, to warn them about the things that God was doing. And those families became taken over with the interests of the truth. The parents, mother and father, and the children bore the responsibilities of that work. Now there's the commitment. It's no picnic, is it? It's a very, very devoted work, but it'll be the most joyful thing in which you are ever engaged. God be with you, Emmanuel, to that end. Well, we go on in verse 2 of chapter 8, and we read, I took unto me faithful witnesses to record. He's going to write this name, Maher Shalal Hashbaz, and you have to be a very good speller. He's going to write that on this board. But nobody knows at that stage just where that name is going to come. It's going to come down upon a little boy in the near future. But for the time being, all it is a message on the board. Maher Shalal Hashbaz. Now, I haven't told you the meaning of that name, but we have mentioned it, haven't we, at other classes. If you've got in your margin a note about the Hebrew, then that's really very accurate. In making speed to the spoil, he hasteneth the prey. Literally, it's simply speed, spoil, haste, prey. Speed, spoil, haste, prey. It's a rather strange name, isn't it, to place upon the board. But can you imagine everybody going past that board and looking up and saying, what does that mean? Speed, spoil, haste, prey. Speed, spoil, haste, pray. What's Isaiah trying to say? Well, clearly, you wouldn't need to be Einstein to recognise that it was going to be a matter of great significance. It was a warning to the house of Judah. And what's more, when he wrote that on the board with the crowd watching as he chiselled into that board, we read in verse 2, I took unto me faithful witnesses to record, whose names are here given, Uriah the priest and Zechariah the son of Jerubbaal. Now, Uriah the priest is really an interesting character because he's mentioned in the King's record. Would you like to come back to the 2 Kings chapter 16? In the 2 Kings chapter 16. You remember that when Ahaz went up to hire Tiglath-Pileser, he went to Damascus, which Tiglath-Pileser, the king of Assyria, had conquered. He conquered the Syrians. Damascus was the capital of the Syrians. And when he went there, Ahaz went up to see him at that site. And we read there in verse 10 that he saw an altar, did Ahaz, that was at Damascus. And King Ahaz sent to Urijah the priest, it's the same name effectively, Urijah the priest, the fashion of the altar. The fact that it's just called Urijah the priest, both here and in Isaiah, would clearly mean that that must be the high priest. No one else would just be referred to as the priest. The fashion of the altar and the pattern of it according to all the workmanship thereof. And Urijah did it. And Urijah the priest built an altar according to all that King Ahaz had sent from Damascus. So Urijah the priest made it against King Ahaz came from Damascus. In other words, he got the whole bunch of the priests and other artificers into a very effective working bee to make sure that was made before Ahaz got back to Jerusalem. Wouldn't that sicken you? And so it says in verse 16 in summary, thus did Urijah the priest according to all that King Ahaz commanded. That man was considered by Isaiah before that time to be a faithful man. But in the interim, he has turned upon him. And a man that Isaiah went and chose that he, as an important person, would see that message chiseled into the board, that man eventually took the message that came from Ahaz, who was collaborating with the Assyrian king. He went and changed the whole ordinance of the temple to fit it in to the terms of the heathen king. What a turncoat indeed was Uriah the priest. However, the other person turns out to be a very interesting and somewhat vague personality. It says, Zechariah, the son of Jerubbaal. Zechariah, the son of Jerubbaal. Now, there is a Zechariah. If you come back to Chronicles, 2 Chronicles chapter 29. And verse 1 says, Hezekiah began to reign when he was 25 years old, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. Hezekiah is Ahaz's son, isn't he? And his mother's name was Abijah, the daughter of Zechariah. And we said at last class, didn't we, that for Hezekiah to be such a wonderful person spiritually, he has to arise from a mother that was spiritually disposed because his father was hopeless. And his mother's name was Abijah, the daughter of a Zechariah. Now, isn't it very likely that this Zechariah of Isaiah chapter 8 verse 2 was in fact the same person? In other words, he was the father-in-law of King Ahaz and a very honoured man indeed. You know, there were some very wonderful Zacharias around at this time. Just passing back in Chronicles just a little, in the 2nd of Chronicles chapter 26. The 2nd of Chronicles 26 and verse 5 says that Uzziah, who was a great king and reigned for 52 years, he sought God in the days of Zechariah, who had understanding in the visions of God. And as long as he sought Yahweh, God made him to prosper. Could that Zechariah not be the same person who, by influence of a well-trained daughter, has become so influential, even marries Ahaz, has a faithful son, and overturns all the ill effects of the kingdom of Ahaz? Well, there's another series of references that we can look up in respect to that later. But just for your interest, does that ring a little bell in the New Testament about Zechariah, the son of Jerubbaal? There's a little point for our discussion class after. All right then, so the name has been upon the board, and these two men have taken witness of it. And then we read in verse 3, "And I went unto the prophetess, and she conceived and bare a son. What shall we call this child? Then said Yahweh to me, call his name Maher Shalal Hashbaz." So then the word that was upon the notice board now becomes a name of his own child. You know, and all the exploitations of Christadelphian sisters in finding yet another Bible name to name their sons and daughters, nobody's yet chosen that one, have they? But hold your breath. It's sure to happen sooner or later. Well, this little boy then is born. Call his name Maher Shalal Hashbaz, and he bears upon his little shoulders, even upon in the tenderness of the cot, he bears upon his shoulders the warning to the kingdom of Judah that that boy is speaking to Judah of the judgment of Assyria coming upon him. So the prophet, in the fullness of those things, says in verse 18, "Behold, I and the children whom Yahweh hath given me are for signs and for wonders in Israel from Yahweh of hosts, which dwelleth in Mount Zion. Behold, I and the children whom Yahweh hath given me are for signs and for wonders." He must have really felt that. It wasn't that he could just sort of go off into the field, could he, and play hopscotch with those boys. The whole family was absolutely caught up in a matter that was of the greatest significance. So that even a little child, dear little boy that he was given, however, a name that spoke of the coming and impending judgment upon the land. And it was coming soon. Verse 4. "For before the child shall have knowledge to cry, my father and my mother." How long does that take? Some children a bit earlier than others. But could we say before he's 2 years of age, eh? Before he's 2 years of age, the riches of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria shall be taken away before the king of Assyria. The record of that is in the 2nd of Kings, chapter 16, verses 5 to 9. Just a quick turn over there. The 2nd of Kings, chapter 16, we read there, "So Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, saying, I am thy servant and thy son. Come up and save me out of the hand of the king of Syria and out of the hand of the king of Israel, which rise up against me. And Ahaz took the silver and gold that was found in the house of Yahweh, part of the rental of that razor, and in the treasures of the king's house, and sent it for a present to the king of Assyria. And the king of Assyria hearkened unto him, for the king of Assyria went up against Damascus and took it and carried the people of it captive to Kir and slew Rezin, who was one of those two kings that Isaiah had spoken to Ahaz about." So there is Assyria destroying Damascus and overturning its king. And we haven't a record of him at that time, Tiglath-Pileser, coming against Israel in the north, but it must have happened at about the same time. So the words of Isaiah came to pass very shortly after the message of Maher Shalal Hashbaz. Because the message indicated speed, didn't it? Haste the spoil, speed the prey. And then in the following words, God remonstrates with a nation that would not heed. Yahweh spake also unto me again, saying, Forasmuch as this people refuseth the waters of Shiloh that go softly, and rejoice in Rezin, who was the king of Syria, and Remaliah's son, who was Pekah, the king of the northern kingdom, while they boast and while they worry about those two kings, giving them importance, giving them strength by means of their concern for them, for as much as this people refuseth the waters of Shiloh that go softly, and are all concerned about Rezin and Remaliah's son, saying in verse 12, a confederacy to all them to whom this people shall say, a confederacy, while they worry themselves about foreign confederacies against them, now therefore, verse 7, there will be indeed a foreign power against them. Now therefore, behold, the Lord bringeth upon them the waters of the river, strong and many, even the king of Assyria and all his glory, and he shall come up over all his channels and go over all his banks. And he shall pass through Judah, he shall overflow and go over. Will he take the lot? Well, he shall reach even to the neck, which is most interesting, isn't it? And the stretching out of his wings shall fill the breadth of thy land, O Emmanuel, like a flood when it comes down the river Murray will find its way into all those areas which are beneath the height of its flood. And it stretches out like the wings that are here described. You remember the winged lion that we have in Daniel chapter 7, which speaks of the Babylonian, the Assyro-Babylonian. So this power would stretch its wings out over the breadth of thy land, O Emmanuel. In other words, despite the fact that this is the land in which God is with us, yet the Assyrian will come upon that land as though it in fact was not the land of Emmanuel. Why did that come, my dear brothers and sisters? Because this people refuseth the waters of Shiloh that go softly. Remember how we were speaking about that last class or the time before? There was a little stream that was rising on the eastern slope of Jerusalem called Gihon, put there by God that that city might have water in an otherwise dry area. And the people were able to take that water into the city even when the Assyrian would be all around that city, so that they would have a refuge, they would have the water of life in all the midst of their troubled circumstances. And you know, they said, that's an accident of geography. It's a topographical fluke. But it wasn't. God said, I placed that water there, but you have refused that. I fashioned it long ago, as he says in the 22nd chapter in verse 9. I fashioned it long ago for your life, but you refuse that and you place it away from you. But because you do that, the waters of a great flood will come upon you. It was a bit like comparing, wasn't it, Jordan with the rivers of Syria. And you remember how that Naaman despised the rivers of Israel, the river Jordan, and thought so much greater of the rivers of Syria. Well, because you look up to the river of Assyria, which is the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers, then you'll get them, because you refused the waters of Siloah that trickled softly indeed. It was only a little stream, but it was life to that people of Judah inside that city. And if they could only see that that was given there of God, then that city would thrive despite all the circumstances that might come upon them. Finally, let us take that theme up in the Psalms. It's a very beautiful psalm, which I'm sure is based absolutely upon these things and given at this time. Psalm 46. Psalm 46, God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore will we not fear, though the earth be removed, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, though the waters thereof roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with the swelling thereof, though the waters of Euphrates might impend upon this whole land, and threaten our very existence, there is a river, the streams whereof shall make glad the city of God, the holy place of the tabernacles of the Most High. Wasn't it Emmanuel's prophecy where that was said? God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God shall help her. And that right early, the heathen raged, the kingdoms were moved. He uttered his voice, the earth melted. Yahweh of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. And then looking forward to the future, before the 185,000 were ever smitten, a vision of the future desolation by the helping hand of God. Come behold the works of Yahweh. Look not upon the legions of Assyria. What desolations he hath made in the earth. He maketh wars to cease unto the end of the earth. He breaketh the bow and cutteth the spear in sunder. He burneth the chariot in the fire. Remember our first hymn? Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted, not only just in Judah, I will be exalted among the heathen, among the confederacy of the foreigners. I will be exalted in the earth. Yahweh of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge.